My castaway this week is a scientist. He was born in South Africa, where his childhood was unhappy, and after university there, he came to England. Here, he rapidly established himself as a leading scientific thinker. His field is embryology, the study of cells and how they develop, but his influence stems from his passionate advocacy of the value of science as a whole. Despite a recent attack of clinical depression, he remains convinced that science provides the only rational foundation for man's beliefs. We must live with uncertainty, he argues, rather than sustain ourselves with improbable beliefs. His job is being the Professor of Biology as Applied to Medicine at University College London, but his public role lies in his position as Chairman of the Committee on Public Understanding of Science. He is Lewis Wolpert. You have, however, currently, Professor Wolpert, become Professor of Depression, haven't you? You've gone very public about this illness you had. Why did you choose to do that?
It was the only time I'd ever been depressed, and it was so unspeakably awful in the first instance. And then I realized that people were slightly embarrassed about me having a depression, and that other people who were depressed were somewhat ashamed of it. It has a stigma, being depressed, and I felt it was very important for this to be removed.
But what kind of depression was yours? Was it just simply a very long, low period?
No. Now, I think the essence of a clinical depression is that one enters a quite different state. It's very, very hard to describe, but first of all, depressives are very, very boring. They are totally negative and totally self-involved. So for people who have to live with them, it's a nightmare. It's very difficult to help them. And when you're in it, it's not just the psychological aspect, but there are all sorts of physical aspects. You feel ill. You can't do anything. You feel hopeless. I was very suicidal. It's really very, very, very nasty.
Completely black. There's nothing...
Nothing can give you any pleasure whatsoever.
But you, in the past, you've written, were a member of the Sock School of Psychiatry. That's
yes.
To say, pull up your socks and get on with it. You obviously tried. You couldn't.
I certainly couldn't. And all my support systems were gone. I couldn't work. I think work's a very good antidote to depression. I couldn't run. I couldn't cycle. Couldn't play tennis. I couldn't do anything.
And you couldn't communicate with people? Could you say to your family, look, just leave me. I'm sure I'll come out of this at some point.
No, I couldn't do that. On the contrary, they were all very nice to me. My children, my wife, my ex-wife, were all very supportive.
But you thought it was the end, did you? Or you wanted it to be the end. How suicidal were you?
I was very suicidal. I thought about nothing else, actually. What's interesting, though, is I didn't do it, nor did I try. I didn't know quite how to do it.
But you thought about how to do it?
All the time. All the time about death, yes.
How did you think about doing it?
Well, I'm frightened of heights, so I couldn't jump from a building. I know that sounds funny.
But in the end, you were rescued by drugs.
Yes. I took a drug related to Prozac called Ceroxat, and that helped me, or unquestionably helped me. And also, I'm totally committed to cognitive therapy. And cognitive therapy is not about trying to find the underlying reasons, but trying to change one's thought patterns to sort of help you out of your constant negativity. There's this nice phrase about that you've got ants, automatic negative thoughts. And you need to be trained to get out of those.
So, tell me about your first record.
Well, I am South African. I left South Africa and I was 23. And I wasn't as unhappy as you suggested in your introduction.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a minute.
And I just would like a South African record, and Kwela is something that's very South African and relates to what one hears on the streets, and I like it.
Lemmy Special and Jimmy Pratt and Lemmy's Jump and Memories, Lewis Wolpert, of your South African youth, which you have said, was not of the happiest.
I wasn't unhappy. I loathed school, but liked my friends. I was an only child. I was quite lonely.
But you said in the past that you felt like a cuckoo in the nest at home. You didn't fit.
Oh, my goodness. I think my parents... I wasn't unhappy. That's unfair. My parents wanted me to be a nice Jewish boy. And I'm not.
Well, maybe what was nasty about you?
I didn't fit into that kind of Jewish community.
What were you? You were a nonconformist, were you, as well?
It's just that I was slightly different to my parents, I think. And so I think that they were always rather puzzled as to who I was.
But Helen Sussman, I think, was an aunt of
yours.
Is an aunt of yours. And she's apparently said quite recently told you that your mother was, quote, a nasty piece of work. How do you react to that?
I can understand. My mother was a complicated woman. And she was enormously protective of the family. And for someone like Helen to come into the family quite young and marry one of her brothers, I can see that as really, my mother could be quite difficult. If you didn't fit with her image as to how Jewish women should behave, you had a very hard time.
Well, now, of course, a traditional psychoanalyst would undoubtedly seize on all of that and say, ah, here is then the root of this man's depression. At long last, after all these years, it's come out. And you would say that's a load of old baloney.
Absolute bunkum.
Why? Why are you so dismissive about that kind of psychotherapy?
Because you can make up any story you like. You know, it's just like Kipling's Just So story, how the elephant got its nose by being pulled by the crocodile or whatever it was. You can't ever validate this. These are just stories. And they're very attractive stories. I think we all use them in our lives. But my depression had absolutely nothing to do with that. My depression had to do with my anxiety about my heart. I have a slight heart condition. I get atrial fibrillation. And I had a very big trip planned to South Africa. And the drugs were making that I was taking was making me depressed, and I got very anxious. I am a hysteric anyhow.
The psychoanalyst would, of course, say that you are repressing those childhood unhappinesses, and you're denying that.
I wasn't that unhappy. No,
there you go again. You see, you're denying it again.
You're beginning to sound like an analyst. It's a very easy role to slip into. Sorry.
Yes, absolutely. No, it is. And it is why people slip into armchair psychology. It
absolutely.
Is, isn't it?
Yes.
But you prefer cognitive therapy. That's to say, well, you explain to me what that is. And give me an example of it, will you, how it worked for you?
Of course. What cognitive therapy, particularly in relation to depression, does is to point out to you how negative your thoughts are. When I was having cognitive therapy, I had not been to a meeting for a very long time. I'd cancelled everything. And I wanted to go to a committee meeting, and I was terrified about going. And what the therapist did was to take me through. She said, well, now, say you walk out. Say you just can't cope with it. How bad will your colleagues think of you? And so forth. In other words, by trying to bring reality into my anxiety, she enabled me to go to the meeting, and that was a very, very big step towards my recovery.
But just going back to you as a boy, from somewhere you inherited, I think, a confidence, didn't you? And also a love of science, an aptitude for science, what?
I always liked scientific things. I felt at home with them. It was almost like a comfort. I enjoyed it.
Tell me about record number two.
Well, record number two is really a reminder of how wonderful it was to go to university. It was terribly exciting. And in my first year, I went to a student conference, which opened up a whole new world for me. And on the way to this conference, I shared a compartment with a friend who sang this song continually. And it's the only song whose words I actually know off by heart. But it does remind me of really a liberation of politics and intellectual life and sort of getting out of school and things like that.
I love the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms about you.
Ella Fitzgerald and Embraceable You. Your scientific pedigree, Lewis Wolpert, is a very interesting one for an embryologist because you began by studying civil engineering. Well, what was the attraction of that?
I was good at mathematics and science at school, and I didn't know what to do. And I chose all on my own to do civil engineering, and I chose civil because it sounded cleaner than mechanical.
So you built bridges, did you?
Well, be very careful, because in the finals of my exam of civil engineering, we had to design a bridge and a water tower. Now, my external examiner demonstrated me conclusively that my water tower would leak and my bridge would fall down, but he put his arm around me and said, "But I think you've got the general idea, young man."
But weren't you also, I mean, they had to pass you, I understand, because you spotted some mistakes.
Yes, we did. In the finals, they made a couple of mistakes in asking us to prove various things, and I went along to them and said, "Look, you can't fail me and my friend." Because we'd worked together. And
was a joint degree, was it?
Well, it wasn't actually. To be absolutely honest, I loathed being an engineer at this stage. And my friend, who did one half and I did the other half, and we taught each other.
What did you do in the exams?
A couple of days before the exams, we taught each other.
But you eventually you went along.
Well, he doesn't remember it, but we both went along to the head and said, "Look, you cannot fail us because you've made these mistakes in two papers." So we were smart enough to pick up the mistakes.
Then you came to London, I think via Israel, where you had something to do with water towers. I hope they didn't leak there. And you studied soil mechanics when you came here. When did you make the big switch to biology?
Well, I wanted to give up engineering. I was desperate to give up engineering. And I was actually going to a course at the London School of Economics and exploring doing physiology or biology at Metz and elsewhere. And a friend of mine in South Africa getting married, Wilfred Steyn, knew of my wanting to get out of engineering. And the day before his wedding, he read an article in Cape Town by Murdoch Mitchison and Michael Swan, who later became chairman of the BBC, but who was then professor of zoology in Edinburgh. And they were looking at the mechanical properties of the cell membrane. And he wrote to me and said, "Lewis, I found what you should do." So my PhD was on the mechanical properties of the cell membrane.
And did you know, when you got into all that and began, did you know you'd found your field at last?
Yes, I think so, yes.
What was the fascination about it? Tell me, I mean, what turns you on about it?
But it's absolutely amazing. You come from one small little egg, one single cell, all of you. I mean, everybody should get out of bed in the morning and realise that they come from one single cell, the fertilised egg. And here you are. That's what we try to understand.
And that's what you've been doing for 40 years?
Yes.
In the same place, attached to London University, I think.
Yes, I was at King's College originally, and now I'm part of University College.
Mm. And never look back. It's always been...
It's been magical, wonderful.
Tell me about record number 3.
I worked in Israel for a year, and I had a friend there who was a music teacher, and she introduced me to chamber music, and she used to take me to concerts, and when the theme changed, she would nudge me. And so I learned to love chamber music.
Part of Beethoven's String Quartet number 15 in A minor, opus 132, played by the Femir Quartet. Obviously, Lewis, you advocate science as a career, and indeed there's been heavy promotion of it in education for some years now. How do you explain the fact, then, that it's still not as popular as the arts? I mean, one statistic which I think seems to be a good example of that is that the number of physics A-level students has fallen by 20% since the early 1980s.
Although, just to put that in context, the applications for engineering and science courses is really very high, I heard recently. Science is hard, and it isn't the way to express your personality. What I mean by that is that if you want a subject where you can, as it were, give your opinion at an early stage, you can do that, say, in English or in history. I'm afraid that's not true if you're doing science. I mean, for example, at early stages in mathematics, just to make the hardest one, is your opinions are rather irrelevant. You have to know really quite a lot before you can make any contribution at all. So it is tough.
Yeah, but it's also I suppose, not so attractive. I mean, as one of your critics, the journalist Simon Jenkins, has written, you know, people would far rather read Shakespeare than learn about the second law of thermodynamics. Why can't you get it across to people that it is that important, then make it somehow more interesting?
Well, I think that some people do it very well. I think that science programmes, like Horizon, for example, on the BBC, do extremely well. They have a large audience.
But then you blame the media for ghettoising science.
Oh, I blame the media for everything. Oh, yes. Look at the BBC and the paranormal at the moment. They are so really just playing to the crowd.
Well, it's not just the BBC, but people enjoy the paranormal. People okay. want to watch programmes about the paranormal. I'm sure, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure in greater numbers than they want to watch programmes about science.
I regret that's probably true, and I must confess that I do like the X-Files.
Well, there you are.
However, there is a difference between having a fictional program like The X-Files and having programs about the paranormal as if it were true and totally uncritical. You would never put on a program saying, well, as a matter of fact, Shakespeare was a woman, you see, who lived in Hampstead. You know, it's that sort of junk that one has presented with the paranormal, and no one is allowed to stand up and say, look, this is all nonsense.
But let's get back to this point about... Yes, no, not at all. I mean, the point I was making about science, which is your point, you wrote a very good book, The Unnatural Nature of Science, which was written for laymen, and what you were saying there is, you know, science is not common sense,
no, it's not.
Which a lot of people assume that, oh, well, if I really put my mind to it, it's very factual, you know, I would be able to sense what was right and what was wrong and which way everything was going, because there's a logic to it. Not true, you say?
I'm afraid not. It's nobody's fault, but the world just isn't built on a common sense basis. In fact, if an idea fits with common sense about the way the world works, you can be virtually certain it will be false.
Give me an example of that, because that very good one in your book about the bullets?
Oh, yes. If you go into a completely flat field, and I've got two bullets, one in my hand, one in a gun, and I fire one horizontally at exactly the same time as I drop the other one, which hits the ground first? And the answer is they both hit the ground at the same time, but one's intuition says it's the one shot will get there later. But that's too complicated. Just think about the tides. I'll bet you're very happy with the idea the moon causes the tides. Mm. And if I say to you why, and I'm holding up my hands now, I say, oh, well, here's the moon, and it's near
it's
to the earth, and
somewhere.
It's pulling on the water here, and that's why it's high tide. But hold on, it's high tide on the other side. It's very complicated. Common sense doesn't bear any relationship to the way the world works.
So are we therefore saying that we lack natural curiosity? Is
no.
that the explanation no. as to why young people don't naturally go for the sciences as easily as they go for the arts? Or because it's easier to bluff in the one than in the other?
I think it's just easier. I also personally think, but I have no direct evidence for that, is that you can make it's more personal. You can make anybody can make a criticism of a poem. I'm afraid there's nothing much you can do with the second law of thermodynamics. You've got to try and understand it.
Tell me about record number four.
Record number four really relates to my ex-wife, Betty Walpert. She's the mother of my four children. And it's Elizabeth Welsh as a singer that she's very fond of.
There's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare.
Elizabeth Welsh singing Stormy Weather. Let me, Lewis Walpert, put one other proposition to you in this discussion about the two cultures, science versus the arts, the humanities. Science isn't attractive because it's not creative. If Watson and Crick hadn't discovered the structure of DNA, then somebody else eventually would do. If Shakespeare hadn't written King Lear, we'd never have had King Lear. Ergo.
What you said is both true and not true. Science is very creative. Watson and Crick working out the structure of DNA was a highly creative act. And we know that Klug and Franklin would have got there about a year later. And simultaneous discovery is common in science. But that means that they're all being creative. You've got to be very creative in science.
Yes, but it makes it less unique, if one can say that. As an act. No one else but Shakespeare could have written
that
Hamlet.
That is absolutely true, and that's one of the differences between the arts and the sciences. Science is a communal activity. If no Watson and Crick, then somebody else. If no Einstein, I don't know, Ferguson, who knows?
But it's worse than that, isn't it? Because every bit of science, every bit of development in science that occurs either uses up or negates that which has gone before, whereas, again, and I think you've used this analogy yourself in your time, you know, Wagner didn't make Mozart irrelevant.
Absolutely. And that is, well, there is this marvellous remark by David Hilbert that the measure of a good scientific paper is how many other papers it makes irrelevant. But that's just the nature of science. But doesn't it make it
less creative?
No, on the contrary. The very fact that you can discover and make some contribution to this wonderful communal structure is an extremely exciting, and we can all share in it. Look, just thinking up a good experiment, I like to think, is a very creative act.
I still find it very difficult, though, to understand the comparison between the two, because, I mean, if we look back at that Beethoven string quartet you played just now, you know, that there was no sudden piece of inspiration or luck that went into that, though it was pure creative genius, wasn't it, that wrote that?
Yes, and I would accept it's quite different from Darwin coming to the theory of evolution. And in fact, I'm the one that goes round and saying that there is very little similar between creativity in the arts and creativity in science. But all sorts of scientists go around saying, and those in the arts saying, creativity in both is very the same. It's a sort of intellectual snobbery of artists want to be like scientists and scientists want to be like artists. I think it is very different.
Do artists want to be like scientists?
Oh, yes.
Or is it more the case that scientists want to be like artists?
I think science envy is very pervasive in our society. A lot of the hostility towards science by the intellectuals in this country, they don't understand a word of it. Here you have the most wonderful triumph of Western culture, not Western culture, of the 20th century, because not peculiarly Western in any way at all, and here they don't understand a word of it.
Record number 5.
I came to Wagner quite late when I was in England, and I am totally devoted to his music. I'm absolutely amazed, not only by how wonderful it is, but by his confidence.
Regine Crespin singing the aria Vares Schmählich from the final act of Wagner's Die Walküre with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Tell me, going back to your breakdown, how did your family... That must be very difficult for a family. I mean, you suddenly aged... What were you at the time, 64?
No, it was only a year ago. I'm 65.
Yes, I mean, just for a family who've always known this strong, independent man, suddenly to be confronted with somebody who couldn't live, couldn't exist outside a hospital.
That's true. I did come out every day.
But you went back in every
I went night. Back every night. I needed to be in hospital. They were very, very worried. And everyone was very, very kind to me. Mm. Very, very nice.
But very difficult.
I think that people who live with depressives, and I particularly worry about children who have depressed parents, have a very, very hard time.
Is it, do you know, statistically extraordinary that you should suddenly be hit by this thing in your mid-60s with having had no real showing of it ever before?
I blame it on the drugs. That's the easiest way of dealing with it. You know, we all make up stories. I have a problem with arrhythmia with my heart. And we all make up stories as to why the arrhythmia occurred. It's because you ate the cheese or you drank too much.
Or you went to work.
And we all try to find these correlations. And I'm just very suspicious of all of them.
So you prefer to think what? That there is simply a biological, a chemical thing in the brain that caused this, that over which you have no control. That's what your preferred explanation.
Well, no. I think there are psychological factors which cause chemical changes, which cause psychological factors. It's like a positive feedback loop. But the blunt fact is it's not understood.
What, therefore, sending you away to this desert island, what's going to happen to you there, do you think? I mean, are you more likely to sink into some kind of psychosomatic depression that you describe as a result of being lonely, or will sort of respite from the work and the pressures perhaps help it? What do you think?
I think I'll be bad on a desert island. I once went camping on my own in South Africa. After one day, I was talking to the sheep. I didn't like it.
And practically, I mean, being
hopeless.
A good...
You're
the civil engineer. Oh, you're the leaky water tower, yes.
I'm leaky water tower. You must understand that I'm the one who cannot understand why anybody wants to cook if they live near a Marks and Spencer. It's impenetrable to me.
So you really won't last long, will you? I mean, no. Both physically and mentally.
No, hopeless.
Tell me about record number 6.
This is how I wooed my present wife, Jill Neville.
Simply that?
Yes.
I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. And the North Pole I have charted. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par.
I Can't Get Started, sung by Gail Rees and Bunny Berrigan. It's difficult to interview a scientist these days without talking about God, because all you seem to want to do really is deny a place for him, with the argument that ultimately everything will be explained by science. Why can't you scientists just leave it? Why can't you shrug and turn away and say, well, look, it's unlikely that we can prove God doesn't exist, but leave it alone?
I have to say that I'm not the one who sort of raised it. I'm the token atheist approached by those involved in religion all the time. It's not me going out and, as it were, singing my song.
But I'm asking you really in your role as chairman of the Society for Public Understanding of Science. I mean, that is, I think, what people feel about science, is that it's become a kind of tyranny, really. They find it quite threatening that there is no place allowed for God in all of this.
My position is really very different. I'm in love with David Hume, the Scottish 18th century philosopher, whose ideas about religion I have nothing to add to them. And he said, look, it's perfectly reasonable to believe in a creator, but what you cannot do is infer any properties of that creator. Now, I am not against religion. My position is very clear. I think there's no evidence for a God. And I'm like David Hume, and, you know, why should I believe in it? The evidence is very poor. In fact, I was at a meeting on God and science very recently, and I was saying I didn't believe in the resurrection. They said, why not? And I said, well, you know, it goes against everything we know. Once you're dead, you're dead. And they said, what would persuade you? Would a miracle persuade you? And I said, well, it would be a very good beginning. But you can only go on what evidence we have.
Well, yes, except that people want to say, look, we want to believe without any evidence. And why can't you leave us to it?
We do. I'm sorry, science. The idea that science is anti-religious is simply false. If you look at scientists in this country, I can bring you scientist after scientist, distinguished scientist after scientist, who's deeply religious.
But as far as you personally are concerned, religion is on a par with the paranormal and astrology.
Oh, yes, there's no question about that. In fact, I now hold the following position, that when human beings became conscious in our evolution, one of the things that happened to them was that they could now think about tomorrow, think about yesterday, think about who they were, think about other human beings. And, of course, one of the key things about being human was they could learn how to manipulate their environment and find explanations for things. Now, there were many things for which they had no explanation at all, not the least being death. And I think those people who found explanations by believing in a supernatural became less anxious than those who didn't. And I think there was a selection for those who did.
So that explains why people are so hooked on programmes about the paranormal.
Absolutely. It is the it is our natural condition.
We need it.
Historically, you needed it. When I say you, I mean everyone. Yes.
So are you a superior being because you don't need it?
Yes.
I see. Tell me about your seventh record.
I think Cosi fan tutti is a truly wonderful opera. And as a friend of mine pointed out, it tells you really something about love. And if you tell someone long enough that you love them, you can actually seduce them by love. It's also a very funny opera. And also, I think the music is wonderful.
Carita Matilla, Anna Sophie von Otter, Francisco Arisa and Thomas Allen singing the quartet from the final act of Mozart's Così fan tutte with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. You're a passionate cyclist, Professor Wolpert. Is this a green consideration or do you just like your bike?
No, it's my illusion of youth. When I'm on my bicycle, I'm 16. I remain 16. And I cycle everywhere. I love my... In fact, my bicycle was just stolen from University College, locked to a cycle rack while I was at a lecture. And I've bought this unbelievably wonderful new one, I must confess. It's a mountain bike, and it's just wonderful, and it's so comfortable, and I'm so happy on
59
it.
59 gears?
24.
Do you get withdrawal symptoms when you don't bike? I mean, is it necessary for you physically? Is it part of...
I need to do something like that. I mean, I do run, and I play tennis, and I cycle.
Have we stumbled on your desert island luxury here?
Oh, yes.
I see. And as you sit there on this island, waiting for rescue to come, let me ask you this. You know, if you had a choice, if God, dare I say, blessed you with the ability to solve one problem that you'd wrestled with all your professional life, what would it be?
Oh, yes, how embryos develop. There's no question about that. I have a particular conceptual framework about how I think how you came from the single egg. And I have this concept of positional information. And I'd just like to know whether it's right. I really would.
But there is no God, so you're not going to be blessed with this.
Well, I think I am right anyhow.
Last record.
I've only just really come to Massenet's Manon recently, and it's just very beautiful music, rather romantic.
Alfredo Kraus singing the aria En fermant les yeux from Massenet's Manon with the Toulouse Orchestra conducted by Michel Plasson. If you could only take one of those eight records, Lewis.
The Beethoven Quartet.
Mm-hmm. And your book?
Hume's Inquiries into Human Nature.
Don't you know it by heart?
Now, I've only read bits of it, I'm afraid. And I'm not keen on philosophers at all. But Hume is something completely different. And it would keep me thinking for as long as I was there.
And your luxury is the bike?
Unquestionably. I never get anywhere without my bicycle.
And you can go round and round in circles for as long as you like. Professor Lewis Wolpert, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.